week of April 28th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 446, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. We're recording on Monday, which means we will have our podcast out before the Tony nominations are announced on Tuesday. So we won't have that information for you. I can predict right now Hadestown and Tootsie and Oklahoma will be the big winners in musicals. And To Kill a Mockingbird will be the big nominee in plays.
What about that Irish movie that I saw?
Oh, The Ferryman. The Ferryman will do very well as well.
Irish movie. Oh, I've got movies on the brain.
Yes, you do. So we're recording on Monday. We've just gotten sad news that director John Singleton has been struggling for his life in the hospital. Apparently, his family is going to say goodbye, and then they're going to remove him from life support sometime today. Obviously, everyone knows John Singleton. He's the first African-American and the youngest person ever to be nominated for Best Director for his work on his debut film and the landmark movie Boys in the Hood. He'd done lots of other stuff since then, a Fast and Furious, one of those movies in the franchise, a string of personal path-breaking films like Poetic Justice starring Janet Jackson and Tupac Shakur. And sadly, today perhaps will be the day that we all say goodbye.
Wow, I did not. I mean, certainly I knew he had a stroke. That was something I knew, of course, but I did not know he was in such bad shape.
There'd even been a rumor that he had already died, but then that was pulled back and said, no, he's on life support. And now the family has made that decision. So wow. A difficult day for them, obviously, and a director who has made his mark on Hollywood, no doubt about it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember interviewing him. I want to say it was for Shaft.
Mm-hmm.
God, I've interviewed him at least five times.
Oh, wow. I'm not sure if I ever have, but there you go. So that's it. We're beginning with the end, the obituary section, though there is one other person we'll cover there. But before we get to the obituaries, what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got nonstop 24-hour-a-day coverage of all the records being broken by Marvel's Avengers Endgame. Woo! That's 24 hours a day, people. 24 hours a day, much like the round-the-clock screenings that began in China late at night on Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, and soon spread across the globe. Our guest is Thanos, who will explain how his plan to wipe out half of all living creatures in the universe is... Wait, hold on. In my ear, I've got... No, he's not. Okay, apparently Thanos is not available. Okay, so unfortunately he won't be able to join us, but we will sit back and stare slack-jawed at the box office weekend that was. And to put it all in context, we'll be joined by our good friend Jeff Boucher of Deadline.com and the super cool superhero blog dubbed Hero Nation. Jeff knows these Marvel movies and all the talent involved as well as anyone, as I'm sure he'll explain. In China, the government is actually a little wary of the TV smash hit, The Story of Yangtze Palace. That's a series we've talked about before. Now, fans of movie subscription services just got another rude awakening. In the United States, Cinemia has shut down. So for refunds, you can contact... Well, actually, don't bother. You're probably not going to get any refunds. On Inside Baseball, where we will share the latest on the showdown between writers and agents, will the standoff upset the plans of Endeavor to go public? And we know why the big agencies aren't signing the new code of conduct. They make a lot of money on packaging. But why haven't any of the dozens of smaller talent agencies signed the code and grabbed a chance to poach some of those major clients away from those big agencies? Apparently, the standoff isn't just about packaging and production companies. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's Avengers Endgame, weekend's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world, and that's what everyone is talking about today, but we do it every week. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from everywhere else. Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Deadline, the LA Times, the New York Times, and yes, you are a listener. And everyone knows the number one movie around the world today. It is, of course, Avengers Endgame. It's opening week. This movie has grossed $1,222,000,000. That's its opening week, its first 5 days, $1,222,000,000. I knew it, and yet when I got to the chart and looked at it, it still looked like a typo.
You know what? I wonder if we're going to talk about all these records that Avengers Endgame broke, but I wonder if one record it will also set is largest second week drop.
Well, no, I, it doesn't matter. It's, you know, it may, but that means it only grossed $500 million its second weekend or something. So what? That's why it's a large second week drop, not because people don't like it, because it made so much darn money. We'll get back to all the records. First, looking at the rest of the charts, at number two around the world is The Curse of La Llorona, the horror flick. $15 million on the weekend, $87 million worldwide. So we jumped from $1,222,000,000 is number one. At number two is $15 million. I mean, that's how many movies wanted to just avoid this film, get out of its way, didn't want to be anywhere near this movie's opening because they knew it was going to be a monster. At number three around the world is Shazam. No, $11 million on the weekend, just about $350 million worldwide. And at number four is another superhero film. It's Captain Marvel. This movie made $10 million on the weekend. And as Sperling pointed out at one point, or maybe it was before the show, it jumped back to number two on the charts because
there was, in North America, it's now number two.
Yeah, because people were so excited. They wanted to see it before they saw Endgame, or they wanted to re-see it, or they were just caught up in the mall, or they couldn't get tickets to Endgame. They said, let's go see Captain Marvel again. It made
well, just to put it in perspective, I mean, you have $350 million is how much Avengers Endgame made in North America. And then number two, you have Captain Marvel. At a measly $8 million.
That's right. The same reason that we pointed out for La Llorona. This weekend, it made $10 million. Its total worldwide is $1,110 million. And remember, this movie is a monster smash hit. It's setting all sorts of records for a movie starring a woman, a female superhero. It's one of the biggest grossing hits of all time after weeks in theaters. It's one of the biggest hits of all time. And yet, Avengers Endgame made more money in its opening week than Captain Marvel will make during its entire run. That's just mind-blowing. And number five is Dumbo, the Disney animated film turned into a live-action film. $10 million on the weekend, $330 million worldwide. It's falling fast. This movie is not going to be a win for Disney any way you slice it. Looking down through the charts to find some other new flicks or any news to tell, Wonder Park, the animated Paramount film that was supposed to turn into a TV series that just passed the $100 million mark, but it cost $100 million to make. We'll have to see if they actually end up making that show after all.
I wonder if the TV show will have a director, unlike the movie, which has no director.
That's right. At number 10, skipping down, is Pet Sematary. That just passed the $100 million mark, but it only cost $20 million to make. So yes, the ongoing world of Stephen King, the Stephen Kingiverse, whatever we would call that, that is not going anywhere as well. At number 11 is a new film. It's the first new film opening up around the world, I think, that we have on our charts. It's the first film brave enough to open up the same weekend as Avengers Endgame, and it is an animated film. It's Pororo, Treasure Island Adventure. It's a South Korean animated film. I think it's the fourth in the movie franchise. It stars a penguin who wants to fly, and it's an adorable TV series, a very popular toy, and now it's opened up in its fourth film adventure, and it weighed $1.7 million this week. And number 12 is Us, the horror flick. That's just about to hit the $250 million mark. And number 13 is another new film. It's actually just being released in a new territory. It's a Belgique animated film about Queen Elizabeth's favorite dog. It's called The Queen's Corgi. And the dog is lost and has to find his way home. And it opened up somewhere else. Maybe this weekend it opened up in China or something. It's at $21 million worldwide, and we don't know the budget. If you do, if you're Belgique and you listen to our podcast and you know the budget for this animated film, tell us.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T @showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we're on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
Finally, we have three more movies on the charts. They're at number 17, 18, and 19. None of them are really tearing it up. They're all made about $3 million at the box office so far. And number 17 is an Italian comedy called But What Does Your Head Say? I suppose that's as opposed to your heart. That's a light comedy about an adult woman who's trying to figure out her way in the world. And number 18 is The Collini Case. This is a German legal thriller, and it's based on a novel by a lawyer turned writer, Ferdinand von Schirach. He's had lots of interesting projects come on, including a play, some short stories and novellas, and now a couple movies. This one is based on the true story of how the courts in Germany handled former Nazis with kid gloves. And this writer, Von Schrock, was not happy about that. And he wrote that novel, and now it's become a film to shine a light on that ugly history. And then at number 19 is a British film. It's a thriller. Maybe not thriller. Maybe that's not the right word, but it's very poorly reviewed. And it stars Judi Dench, one of their great actors. It's called Red Joan. And she plays a real life British woman who spied for the KGB for decades. The British sure love their spies, don't they? They all seem to spy on each other. It's endless. Do you not know this? Yes, there's Cambridge spies and all these. But the British spies, they're just always there. I don't know. There's something about Britain. Maybe it's because they're so cheek by jowl with all the other countries. And I'm British, so you know, I'm not casting aspersions. It's just an interesting thing. But what's also interesting is Avengers Endgame. Oh my God, the records that were broken.
Yeah, and you know what's shocking is that you know they hardly sell records anymore. I mean, I know vinyls on the the box office records. Yes, hey, I'm in town all week, people.
Yes, you are. The first record in North America, Avengers Endgame grossed $100 million in 17 hours, in its first 17 hours. In China, it grossed $107 million in its first 24 hours. That's because in China, they started 7 hours earlier. They started at midnight screening the movie, whereas in North America, it started like late Thursday afternoon, early evening.
Yeah, you know, first of all, I tried to go see another movie this weekend that wasn't Avengers Endgame. Well, no, of course I didn't. But if I did try to do that, there were over at the ArcLight in Sherman Oaks, they showed three movies. And Avengers Endgame was on like 10 screens, maybe more. Captain Marvel was the other movie, and Little was the third movie.
Yeah, AMC alone had 60,000 screenings of the movies, 60,000 showtimes. Which, I mean, that must blow your mind. Among the other records, in 4 days, Avengers Endgame grossed $356 million in North America. Put that in perspective, the record that they broke was $250 million. So the record set by Infinity War, 1 year earlier, by the way, another Avengers movie, leapfrogged to $356 million. That's a ton of money. In 5 days, it grossed $329 million in China. They got a lot of screens and they need to fill them up. Worldwide, in 5 days, this movie grossed $1.2 billion. That's almost double the last record, which was $640 million in its opening week. That was set by Avengers Infinity War. By the way, this is an April release. Doesn't that still mean something?
It does. And, you know, in one weekend, the box office went from being 17% down year over year for the entire year to only 3% down, which is, you know, people are like, oh, thank goodness. I look at that and say, well, it's really not a great thing that one movie did that.
No, that's crazy. Yes, don't have, why do people always do that? Well, if you take out the biggest hit, then it's not so impressive. Well, that's why we make, you always want big hits. It is impressive. If it was the only movie that had audiences going and made $5 trillion and nothing else made a penny, yes. But there's a broad slate of profitable movies like Captain Marvel. $1 billion. This is not a one movie phenomenon. Big hits are big hits, and there's a broad array of films making money. So this is not a bad sign that there's a monster hit at the box office. That's silly. You know, yeah, but if you take out Thriller, it was a bad year at the record stores. Yeah, but if you take out Star Wars, it's a bad year at the box. Well, no, it wasn't. It was a good year. It just happens that the biggest hit of all was really big.
Well, okay, let's look at a couple of records that were broken just at AMC alone, okay? On Saturday.
That's the biggest chain in North America?
Yes, it is.
And I'm an A-plus Stubbs member, whatever that's called. I'm on the A-list.
Oh, okay. So you pay the monthly fee?
I do.
Okay. Well, they sold 2.6 million tickets on Saturday alone. That's a record for, you know, a single day attendance record.
But I don't know what to compare that to, because I don't know what AMC would normally do or anything like that.
Well, they said it broke the attendance record for AMC set during the opening weekend of Black Panther 14 months earlier. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, everybody always wonders, well, how much money are they making on popcorn and soda?
Yeah.
Okay, everybody wants to know. Well, they set a single day record on Friday for food and beverage revenue. $13 million that circuit alone earned on food and beverage on Friday.
Which is
a record. But as soon as they were able to kind of ink that into their record books, the very next day.
Well, Saturday is a bigger day for sales.
They earned $15 million on food and beverage.
Oh, absolutely.
Sales.
Yeah. Saturday would be the day I would expect it to happen, because you got all day and all night. Yeah. And some of those people went to IMAX screens worldwide. In its first 5 days, Avengers Endgame grossed $91 million on IMAX screens. And 3D had a good day, didn't it?
Yes, 40% of worldwide grosses. Now, notice I did say worldwide. I didn't say North America or US or China. I just said worldwide because RealD is reporting that 40% of worldwide grosses, $540 million, came from 3D.
That's right. One estimate I saw, I think it was just a snapshot of one day, so it might have trended downward as the week continued. But one estimate says 20% of North American gross came from 3D, and then another 20% came from IMAX and premium large format screenings. So 20% is pretty good, and you think 45% of worldwide gross, well, that's pretty good, except it's not. Even with the biggest movie in the world, they still couldn't break 50% anymore. And at one point, we were seeing like 70, 80% of opening weekend sales being in 3D, weren't we?
Well, yes, those were early days, like Avatar was like 70%. And that said, and like Clash of the Titans, when 3D was new and exciting, and like most of the 3D movies or movies that were in 3D had more screenings in 3D than 2D. Nowadays, it's quite the opposite. To find the 3D showing, it's like there's 50 screenings in 2D and like there's five.
Well, not this weekend. And I frankly would love to see a survey of people who was forced to buy a 3D ticket because the 2D screening was sold out.
Well, I can tell you that I did look at this, the 3D screenings, there were literally 10 per day when there were like 100 at this one, maybe not 100. I think it was like 65 screenings at this one theater in LA, and there were 10 3D screenings.
So I didn't see a ratio like that. I saw a bigger ratio,
that's
but yeah.
Anecdotal, and it's just me looking at one or two movie theaters.
Well, looking at this series, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, there are 22 films now in the series. I'm assuming this movie will gross another $1 billion. Because it opened to $1.2 billion. I'm sure it will hit $2 billion. That means when all is said and done, the series as a whole will have grossed at least $20 billion, almost averaging $1 billion per movie. That's unbelievable. And guess what? The four-day total that it grossed in North America, $356 million, that set an all-time record at the box office for the highest grossing weekend, meaning all the movies combined. The previous record was $314 million for an entire slate of movies playing in a weekend. This time, that record was broken by one movie alone. And obviously, the whole weekend box office is bigger than that. I think it's close to $400 million. But essentially, on its own, it's at the biggest weekend of all time for all movies combined.
But Michael, let's face it. Movies and movie going is dead, okay?
That's right.
Netflix told me.
The Lord and Miller brothers, they just signed a new deal with Sony, a 9-figure deal that just happened while we've been on the air. They're going to bring a Spider-Verse animated show to television. Their argument is that streaming and theatrical feed each other, which I think we would agree with very strongly, that one plays off the other. You know, a new season on a network TV, you can watch the past seasons on a streaming service or on demand. You like a movie, you're excited to see a movie, you want to catch up on the other ones, or you want to fill in the holes, your friend said it was cool. There it is on streaming or on demand, ready for you to catch up at any time. I watched 3.5 seasons of Game of Thrones in about 2 weeks because I said, oh my God, I have to just deal with it and know that I have to watch the finale. I have no choice. So I agree with them. I think streaming and theatrical feed off each other. They are not natural enemies in any way, shape, or form. Because would you want to see Endgame on your TV? Sure, but I'd rather see it in a theater. And here's one statistic I think that really helps encapsulate how big this movie was. It played on how many screens in North America?
I think, I don't know.
4,500, something like that?
Well, that was locations.
Locations, right. No, I'm sorry. Locations, hard tops. And then how many screens it played, we don't even know, really. But yeah, locations, it played in 4,500 hard tops, meaning if you've got a 20-screen AMC or Regal in your neighborhood, that's one location. It may have been on 10 or 15 of those screens there, but that's 4,500 locations or hard tops. And its per-screen average around the country in North America was $75,000 per screen. $75,000 per screen is a massive number if your movie opens on one screen. If you have a film that opens in one screen in New York and that's what you gross, you go, wow, people are really excited to see this movie. And they did that playing everywhere. That's really mind-blowing. Now, you know, can we put aside a couple things? First of all, the running time. I've been arguing this for a while with you. We never need to mention the running, and it never will again. The technology has allowed that to not matter, right?
Well, technology has allowed it to not matter, number one. Number two, they knew that this was not a film that was going to be on just the one screen. And so you're only going to get 3 showings per day instead of the 4 showings per day. They knew that when this movie opened, it was going to be on 5 screens in every venue that that was going to play it. That was always a concern when you like Titanic. Okay. First of
but
all,
if it opened today, they would just play it on as many screens as possible. Right.
Correct.
There's no ceiling on what your movie can gross in a weekend.
Correct.
Practically speaking, even if it is 3 hours long, even if it's 4 hours long, you know, they started screenings at midnight. So the running time does not matter anymore. I don't think it's mattered for quite a while, frankly. And really, it doesn't matter anymore. You don't have physical prints. You don't have to move, one reel from one room to another so you can have a second screening while the first screening is still going on and all that fun stuff. You know, people used to have to run back and forth. You'd start a movie and half an hour later, you'd grab that first reel and run it to another theater, you know, another screen so that you could start the movie there too.
Well, that's when they had things, these little people called projectionists in the booth. Which
now they
don't.
Now they have a button, and there's no way to know really how much money they saved. It used to be you had to print up celluloid, you had to print up a copy of a movie. Then for a while, you had to pay a virtual print fee because theater chains had converted over to digital, and they needed help paying off that very expensive equipment. Those days are basically gone, and the fact is, it wouldn't have even been physically possible to open a movie like this all over the world with a 3-hour running time and create enough physical prints to make that happen. That just would have been such an overwhelming project, and it would have cost so much money, and you wouldn't get it back because you couldn't then send the prints to China and India and France. So it just wouldn't have happened, and the cost would have just been astronomical just to print up the celluloid, right?
Yes, it would have been, you know, you want to talk about an expense to print what, you know, 14, 15, 20,000 prints. You're talking about, figure $1,000 or $800 times 20,000. I mean, that's a lot, right? I mean,
yeah, that's tens of millions of dollars.
Don't ask me to do the math.
Apparently, that's not your strong suit.
No, it never has been.
I would like everybody who has done box office analysis to stop talking about opening weekend. I'd like everybody to stop using the word preview. I'd like them to stop talking about how much Endgame grossed on Friday. It set a record, they say, of $156 million. No, it didn't. It grossed $60 million on Thursday and $96 million on Friday. It did not gross $156 million on Friday. And as the Thursday showings get bigger and bigger, I mean, $60 million, it becomes more and more absurd to shove that into Friday and say, and then have a little caveat. Well, you know, including the Thursday screens. It's not. It opened on Thursday. It didn't preview on Thursday. In China, it opened up on Wednesday. That's what it did. Instead of talking about opening weekend and stuff like that, they need to say how much it grossed in 1 day. 2 days, 3 days, in its first 3 days, it grossed this. In its first 4 days, it grossed this. In its first 5 days, it grossed that. It did not gross $1.2 billion worldwide on its opening weekend. It didn't. It opened on Wednesday in China. On Thursday in North America.
I did see one story that said it was going to make $1.2 billion in its first week.
Right, exactly. And I think that's what we need to do. And instead of bothering with 4-day weekend or 3-day weekend or 5-day opening weekend and all that nonsense, we should recognize A, movies open on Thursdays now, so that's not a 3-day weekend. It's B, there are so many times of the year, in North America at least, where you have a July 4th weekend, a Christmas, Thanksgiving, that New Year's spread, summertime, where focusing on Friday, Saturday, Sunday just doesn't make any sense, especially when movies open up on Thursday, and maybe you've got July 4th on a Tuesday. And so worrying about all that is just nonsense. And you should not be comparing 4-day grosses to 3-day grosses when you're looking at the historic record of how much money movies have made. It's just not fair. And yes, we can always say, well, yeah, but Star Wars only opened up on Friday. It didn't open up on Thursday, or it didn't start screenings midnight Wednesday, Thursday. Well, fine. We understand, you know, it's a different world, but just forget the weekend. It's not true anymore. And finally, when we're talking about a movie after it's opened up on its opening weekend, shouldn't be talking about what it grossed on its second weekend. There's this weird thing where you talk about the opening box office, and then the next week you talk about what it made Friday through Sunday, and you ignore Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Those box office totals are added into the final total box office, but you never mention them after the opening. It's like this weird black hole, like it made $8 million or $7 million or $20 million Monday through Thursday, but you don't mention it. So I think the weekend box office should become the week's box office. On Monday, we talk about what movies made in the past week, not the weekend, because movies can open up on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. They almost never open up on a Friday anymore. That's what I know. Does it make sense?
I understand what you're saying. I wonder what our guest will have to say.
Yeah, Jeff isn't big on box office numbers. He's more about the characters, the stories, the backstory of the films and how they got to be made. And I'm excited to have him here on the show.
Well, Michael, you're right. It is a good time to bring in Jeff Boucher, who is the genre editor over at Deadline.com. Or is it Deadline Hollywood? I don't know. Jeff Boucher, thank you for joining us. And of course, longtime fans of the show, longtime listeners already know who Jeff Boucher is. But why don't you explain a little bit about what you're doing at Deadline, Jeff?
Yeah, sure. I am the genre editor, and for us, that means science fiction, fantasy, superheroes, horror, video game-based films, and TV. And I cover all that stuff for the urgent news website that Hollywood turns to.
So let me ask you this, because you're covering all of that, what does anybody else have to cover? So that's basically every movie and television show being made today, and so the rest of the people just cover what, like the Writers Guild and stuff like that?
Precisely. Apparently, yeah. That's all they do. You know, there's 30, 40 people, and they just sit around and watch me.
And you also oversee the blog Hero Nation, of course, for Deadline, which is sort of a silo there, which has great up-to-date fun stuff about all that world.
Yeah, exactly. Hero Nation, and we're going to be expanding that. It's going to have some live events that we're going to be announcing, and like a newsletter you can subscribe to, and some other kind of cool stuff that we're, you know, putting together for around Comic-Con, you know, San Diego this summer.
Well, Jeff, you grew up loving comic books. And I wonder, when you were high school and college, did you like lose dates because you mentioned comic books? Did you have to wait for the second or third date before they saw your comic book collection or realized how much you were into it? I mean, comic books were not cool. They may not even be cool today. I don't know.
I was feeling so good about life. Now this. No, yeah, I made a fatal error, not a fatal error. I made a traumatic error in eighth grade when I wrote my first piece of journalism, which was a cover story in the Pines Middle School, Pembroke Pines Middle School Panther Print newspaper in South Florida. And the headline was How to Collect Comic Books. And it had a picture of me holding my comic books. Pretty much next 5 years, not a single day. Yeah.
Well, and I say that because what a remarkable moment we're at right now for people who did grow up loving comic books and fantasy and all this stuff that got treated with disdain, truly. Right now, a Marvel movie just dominated the world. In a sense, almost hundreds of million people around the world stopped to watch this movie. On television, a drama about dragons and zombies is the biggest and most acclaimed series out there in the world. Harry Potter is on Broadway, and it's one of the most acclaimed and popular plays on the Great White Way. I mean, it's a good time to be a geek, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, I think that a couple of things happened. It didn't just happen out of a vacuum. I think these things always would have been popular and stuff. I just think that until CGI reached a point where you could achieve the world that, you know, somebody like Tolkien or Jack Kirby imagined, before that, it just looked cheesy. And so you couldn't get great directors and you couldn't get great actors. You look at people like Christopher Reeve and Leonard Nimoy and how they were typecast because they were in these things that people didn't really take seriously. Adults didn't. Mainstream kind of elevated taste didn't take those things seriously. So when that started changing, I think, you know, around The Matrix and Terminator 2 and, you know, where you started seeing the special visual effects really reach a level where you could have a world creation, you started getting the filmmakers and actors that the material deserved, because no one wants to look stupid. You know, I think that's why people don't do things. They're afraid they're going to look stupid. And also people like Sam Raimi, directors like that who grew up loving comics. You know, Dick Donner, who directed the Superman movie that came out in 1978 with Christopher Reeve, he loved Superman, but he didn't really grow up loving it. I mean, he liked the character and everything, but it wasn't the way that he didn't have the passion and respect it as a entertainment medium through, you know, his adulthood, as opposed to like Sam Raimi, who loved Spider-Man his whole life, you know, and respected and saw the source material as something that was almost sacred.
Well, let me ask you something. A journalist such as yourself, this weekend, were you allowed to, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Sleep, actually. Were you allowed to sleep, or were you on call 24 hours a day just to cover every single box office record that was being broken on a minute-by-minute basis?
Well, you know, this is actually where the rest of the people that were sitting idly around the office that, of course, I'm being facetious. They we have box office folks, and they're so specialized at doing that, and so plugged into that, that, you know, that baton was handed off. So I actually had a fairly calm weekend. I only ended up writing one story this weekend because there was such a focus on the box office, and also the way Deadline kind of approaches coverage, since it is geared toward the industry more than it's geared toward the consumer. By the time a movie opens, that's almost the finish line for us. Like, you know, they want me writing about stuff that hasn't even been announced yet. Ideally,
you be the place where it's announced.
that's the goal.
Could you just announce stuff that you want to see have happen and then like make the studios do it? Like, yeah, you know, I don't know, Fantastic Four reboot. And then, you know, the studios go, yeah, that's a pretty good idea. We should do that.
I can absolutely do that exactly one time. Because then I would be fired.
So did you like Endgame? And do you think it's a really good movie? And please note, those are two different questions.
And also please note that some of us, and I'm speaking for a friend, have not seen the movie yet.
Yeah, don't worry. Don't worry. No spoilers here. I think it is a good movie, and I think I liked it. I liked it, and it is a good movie.
Well, there you go. Obviously, a lot of other people did. It got great ratings, great scores from the audiences. Critics were polite and kind to it. I don't think it's as well reviewed, perhaps, as, say, Black Panther or the Sam Raimi Spider-Man or certainly Superman the movie. But boy, did it deliver in terms of epic scale and people loving it. There are two big money shots in the movie, and I think we can talk about them without spoiling the movie. There's a big battle scene. I don't think that gives anything away. And this one particular battle scene, similar to what we saw in Game of Thrones over the weekend, is just huge and epic and scale. And in, you're not seeing every Marvel character, but you're seeing just an array of superheroes all in one battle like you've probably never seen before. And then you have an array of villains on the other side. And it's the sort of thing you would see in a comic book, in a double truck, you know, double page spread. And you'd see this epic visionary idea of people, you know, facing off against each other. But to see it on the screen, actually sort of quote unquote in real life, and to see it done seriously and with actors who've been in movies that are, you love, you know, like you liked Black Panther or you liked Iron Man, you liked Captain America, and you've seen them in these other movies. And now here they all are together, that sort of moment that you've seen in comic books, which is still pretty rare there, to see it on the big screen. That must've just been, you know, mind blowing.
You're exactly right. And it's one of those things that that's the thrill, is to see, you know, like, you know, I remember reading Kree Skrull War and Avengers comics, you know, Neil Adams art, and just studying the pages because of these massive, you know, clashes between these armies of heroes and villains and gods and monsters and all the different things that Marvel recruits into their mythology, you know. And that was that's the great treat of being a comic book fan. That's why also things like, you know, the Secret Wars, which is what I want the next Avengers movie to be.
That's the big arc.
I heard there were no Avengers new. This was supposed to be the last Avengers movie. You know, last Avengers movie before the next Avengers movie.
There'll never be another Marvel film. No. I mean, as far as the Marvel guys, all those guys, like, I think it would be a great way to, as a fan, I think it'd be a great way to bring the Fox characters in, is that you just do Secret Wars and you do a movie that has like Hugh Jackman as Wolverine and Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool and Chris Hemsworth as Thor. And you just pick 15 people and let them hit each other over the head for a couple hours.
I don't know that storyline. When did that Secret Wars, when was that written? When did that happen in terms of comic books?
Oh, okay. I'm like just dropping comic book 80s references like they're normal. See, this is what's happened with the world. I start thinking like everybody is...
knows what you were talking about.
Yeah. Well, there was this... it was a pretty ingenious thing that happened in the 80s. There was I think it was 12 part series, or might have been 10, and it was called Secret Wars, and it was inspired by a toy line. They came to Marvel and said, we want to do, I think it was Hasbro, I'm not really sure about that right now. They said they want to do a new line of toys with new costumes and stuff like that, and they came up with a catchy name. So Marvel did a comic book that just fit the title. Jim Shooter, who was editor-in-chief over there at that time, and it became very, very popular. It's the one that introduced the black costume for Spider-Man, that, you know, and the idea that would become Venom. So, and it basically, you had Magneto, and you had the Fantastic Four, and you had some of the Avengers, and they were all thrown into this world, and they were representing different champions, and they had to fight each other. So it was a competition it's a Texas cage match, cosmic style.
So it was like the UFC before the UFC.
Yeah.
Or during the WWE, I should say, if it's the mid-80s.
Yeah, exactly. It was the Rowdy Piper, Hulk Hogan, Superfly, Jimmy Snuka of comic books.
We have just had a whole bunch of people pause the recording to go Google all of those names.
So now we know on Game of Thrones that characters died, and we knew that in this epic battle that a price would be paid. Some people were going to die. We didn't know who going into Endgame, and we don't need to spoil that, and we won't. But when you kill off a major character, you know, you want it to have some weight, and when you time travel and go back and bring them back, it tends to have less weight. Now, the comic books kill off major characters and they bring them back, or they rethink them completely with new writers and creators, tackling a series like Thor or Superman or Batman. I'm wondering what it's like in a movie. All right, we've had some of these actors, all the people associated with these movies for, over a decade, 22 films now. And does it have a different impact when you kill off a major character? Because we know that some of these actors will never play these characters again. They're really hanging up the cape or whatever it may be in terms of what paraphernalia they have, the shield, the iron suit, whatever it might be. So we know that some of these people are not going to come back to these characters. And so they really are gone. You know, whoever played that role will never play it again. We know there will be another Spider-Man, another Thor, another, Captain America, whomever it is, but it won't be that actor anymore that you've grown to love over a decade. So I think it still kind of has a real impact.
I think you're right. And I think it's comparable to kind of beloved television characters, because you have that sort of persistence of the conversation between the audience and the art. In a way that you typically don't in film, and the only thing in film you had characters like Freddy or Krueger or Jason, get killed and brought back again and again and again. That sort of diminishes the weight of a screen death. But we haven't really had anything like the Marvel Universe with this sort of lattice work of connected films that have stretched over a decade, 22 movies. There's really no comparison in the history of feature film that holds up. So you're absolutely right, Michael. I mean, there's that the connection, the affinity, and the familiarity, and these are beloved characters too. And also the audience, a lot of the audience has grown up watching these characters too. You know, I mean, for us, I'm quite old, so. It doesn't feel like I grew up.
But if you're 10 growing up with Robert Downey Jr. playing Iron Man, he is Iron Man.
Absolutely. And you have seen him go through a lot. You've seen him, probably 7 films that he's been in, 8 films, I'm not sure. And he's gone up and down and a lot of different things. Same with.
Well, think about it. If you were 10 when Robert Downey Jr.
Now you're 21, you're graduating college.
Yeah, you can literally drink now.
Yeah, and you may want to after the Avengers.
I saw people coming out of the theaters, and I knew half of them were heading on Sunday. I knew half of them had to head home and hit their DVR to watch Game of Thrones.
It was a big weekend for the Starks.
That's right.
All the Starks, every place.
And Starks everywhere. We're trying to save the world.
Yeah.
They're doing their damnedest. So, you've been to Comic-Con, and you've been there when they had that great moment where they brought out all the actors who were going to play the Avengers for the first time. It was a total surprise, and you saw the actors in person. And we have all interviewed lots of actors and directors, so we forget what a thrill it is to be in the same room with just one actor that you know and recognize. I mean, that's exciting. And when you see all of them together, that's really, really cool. And, that doesn't happen much in your lifetime if you're just a regular person. So I felt like this movie, there was another money shot in this movie because there is a funeral. That's not giving anything away. We know the characters will die. And there's a money shot with a parade of heroes. And I felt like it wasn't even a shot or a scene. It was just a photo op. Like, here are all the superheroes standing together at one moment. And it wasn't like a battle scene where you couldn't catch your breath. It's just, here they are. And they were all in the same scene together. And I thought back to Comic-Con and how bringing them all together is so powerful for fans.
Absolutely. It was like, you're exactly right. And, I was the moderator of that panel.
I know.
And it was the closest thing to, it was like a rock concert broke out at a comic book convention. It was like all of a sudden like everybody was, you know, normal. And then U2 came out because everybody just went ballistic. it definitely had that impact of that you're saying. It felt like a photo op. It reminded me of, oddly, of the Hall of Presidents.
Like
it felt,
yeah, exactly. The animatronic, you know, Green Hulk.
Yeah, like, wow, this is the only time I've ever seen Rutherford B. Hayes and Benjamin Harrison together.
You know, actually, there's I think it was Screen Crush that did this, like, you know, you watch all 18 films before you go see Endgame, or, you know, they basically, and it was very humorous, and they kind of had clips of all the films leading up to Endgame, or maybe it was Infinity War. I can't remember, but they went through all of these movies, and from Michael Douglas to Anthony Hopkins to Kate.
Oh, the big names, a lot of talent. Yeah.
I thought, you know what? If you watch something like that, because it goes through the whole story arcs and all the storylines in like under 5 minutes, I thought, if you are an actor and you see that 5 minutes and you're not in it, you better call your agent, because it was literally every name over the last 15 years.
Exactly. It's like being Irish or British and not in the Harry Potter film.
Exactly. You just kill yourself.
Unless you're Ian McKellen. I mean, he's the only one. Like, I mean, it's just, and ladies and gentlemen, Ian McKellen, who's not in Harry Potter. you know, it's like a roll call. But yeah, you're right. And I talked to Kevin Feige, the president of Marvel Studios, about the first Iron Man film and the casting. And he said that the casting of Jeff Bridges was essential in that film. And you know, it's kind of easy to forget that Jeff Bridges was in that movie. Only because his character really never came back, and it's been a while. You know, it's 11 years now, but it was a hallmark that he took from the Superman movie.
Have Marlon Brando.
Yeah, Marlon Brando and Glenn Ford, and
pay him what you need to pay him. Gene Hackman.
Yeah, Jackie Cooper, and
Gene Hackman. Yeah.
And Gene Hackman and Ned Beatty, just for laughs. There's a lot of talent. There's a lot of Oscar nominees and Oscar winners. And if you look at it, I think that there's been an Oscar nominee or an Oscar winner in every Marvel film.
People think these movies are just printing money. It's so easy to do. It's so simple. It's important to remember when you go back to Iron Man, you had Jon Favreau, who'd never done any movie remotely like this, being given the wheel to do a big budget movie, bringing in Robert Downey Jr., who had addiction issues and was a problem on the sets and needed to make a comeback. He was not a safe bet. And Iron Man is a character almost nobody cared about. I certainly barely had heard of him. 99% of the general public had barely heard of him. He was not even a huge character for comic book fans. So to make that the launch of what became this, let's just remember how ballsy that was.
It was huge. And I did a story at the time. I did a set visit while they were making the movie, and then did a story before the movie came out. And it's visiting the set. That's when I met Feige for the first time, met Favreau, who was coming off Zathura, and was a huge failure. And I remember asking him how that was. And he goes, you know, some movies are released, other ones escape. Which I thought was a great, I don't know. I'm not sure what it means, but I thought it was very funny. But they, you know, I did a story at the time, and the headline was, "Here comes the B team," because it was, I said they don't have Spider-Man, they don't have the X-Men, they don't have the Fantastic Four. You know, here comes the B team. And Feige got really, really upset. And I said, well, I'm just trying to illustrate what the challenge is. But he actually cut that headline out and put it above his desk and used it as like
motivation.
Locker room clipboard.
Oh, nice.
You know, and he would mention it again and again, like over the years. And he mentioned it at kind of forgetting that I wrote it. And yeah. So I stopped telling him, you know, I wrote that because I didn't want to keep emphasizing it, because apparently it really stuck in his craw. So I take credit for everything.
They turned Iron Man into the A-Team.
They did. And now, and this is sort of the kind of the subtle revisionist history of just momentum and contemporaneous life, is that now everybody, when they describe Iron Man, they say that, you know, that it's now presumed that he was a huge comic book character before that movie, because people don't really know. So they just kind of fill in that blank. 'Cause I've talked to people like saying, you know, Iron Man, one of the great, you know, Marvel characters ever. And I'm like, you know, I don't know, dude. I mean, I bought it and I had it, but it wasn't ever the book, or he was never the character. He was always kind of, to me, like Bruce Wayne with a paint job.
Wait a second. What did you call it? A comic book? What is that?
Exactly. Well, a long time ago.
And that brings us to the irony that comic book sales have not reignited, even though all these movies are so popular. And we've talked before, and you've posited the idea that Marvel is in the storytelling business, and it might be on TV or movies or comic books or graphic novels or video games. It's not necessarily just that monthly release. But as this movie comes out, St. Mark's Comics in New York City, one of the last landmark comic book stores, has just closed, making it harder and harder for people to pick up a comic book. In fact, I think Kevin Feige was at some event, and a little girl raised her hand and said, "Where can I buy a comic book?" Because there are so few places. And so I'm wondering the state of comic books right now. 600 to 1,000 comic books are probably published each month, and comic stores must gamble on which ones to buy and how many copies, because they aren't allowed to do any returns. That makes their life very hard. It makes it hard for newcomers to break through when there are so few comic stores left. And some people are predicting the idea that monthly comic release will end, and everyone will just switch to graphic novels, that you'll do an entire season rather than release an episode at a time. I think that's how I would compare it. Does that ring true to you as something that might actually be on the horizon?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a very strange situation, and it's such a curious history that's led comic books to this point where there's only one distributor that matters, and it's Diamond Comics, and the situation is, as you say, that there's no returns, and there's also the numbering. The publishers know that a number one issue is what everybody wants. So it used to be a number one issue was very rare. Like, you know, you know Detective Comics ran for, you know, when I was a kid, like, it had been publishing for 60 years, and you know, Action Comics for 60 years, and Adventure Comics for 60 years. And you didn't get number ones very often. And now they come out all the time, and it'll be like a 4-issue series and then another 4-issue series. And nobody wants issue number 2, issue number 3, not so much. So, you know, it becomes this really kind of top heavy, strange marketplace, where it's hard to make a mark. And also, you know, you can't buy it at 7-Eleven, you can't buy it at drugstores like when I was a kid. And now, you know, if you have Pixar and you have Xbox, and you look at a comic book and you're 12, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's just not where the kids are at. Like, if you put a stack of comic books on the table when I was a kid, every kid would go and get it. Now, if you put it next to a smartphone, no one's picking up the comics, and that's not the comic book's fault. I don't know that that's actually a crisis, because the characters, again, are reaching a bigger audience than ever. The stories are done with higher quality than ever, and it's also these franchises. What Kevin Feige's done is he's elevating people, as you mentioned. You know, Favreau's directing huge blockbusters for Disney. He was a guy who might not have got another chance to make a movie after Zathura. And certainly not one that was as big as Iron Man. And Downey, you know, he wouldn't have gotten that part. He wouldn't be back the way he is now if it wasn't for Kevin Feige and Jon Favreau. And wouldn't we all be sad about that? You know. So,
well, what's really interesting to me is that, you know, you talk about the B team. You know, Iron Man being on the B team, but who knew Kevin Feige's name before all of this? 10 years ago, you would have said Kevin Feige, and then had to explain he's the head of Marvel and he's in charge of all of their filmed entertainment. And now he's kind of a household name.
You're exactly right. And it's surreal. Feige made a lot of big decisions on the X-Men movies when he was working for Lawrence Shuler Donner. And we keep coming back to that Donner name, don't we? Always. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he was one that said, he advised on the first X-Men movie, telling Avi Arad and Bryan Singer the producers what parts of the Marvel Comics mythology were essential and what parts could be jettisoned. You know, like, no, we don't need the costumes if they wear this leather. Yes, you do need Wolverine's hair to look weird. No, you don't need, you know, and, you know, Rogue doesn't need to be exactly like the character in the comics, but Wolverine really should. You know, like, he was almost like the integrity officer. And that really took him far. But he worked on those X-Men films and also on the Spider-Man films before he went to Marvel Studios. And even that day on Iron Man, when I met him, he wasn't the guy in charge of Marvel. David Mizell was, and Kevin Rose, and continued. And he's not a very political guy, but he's very, very savvy. And he, like a sports manager, a general manager in sports, he found a way to make these movies not as expensive as anybody else was making them. I mean, you got to remember that first Iron Man movie was $180 million budget. I mean, there was, you know, movies getting made for 200, north of 200. That was a pretty lean budget for the movie that it delivered. And all along, you know, Marvel doesn't pay very well. And Disney isn't known for paying very well. And that's one of the reasons I think that, you know, you saw him get people like Robert Downey Jr. Chris Hemsworth was a soap opera actor in Australia before they got him. Chris Evans had been in the Fantastic Four movie, and that, I mean, why would you give him another shot at being another Marvel hero? You know, Joe Johnston, the guy that directed the first Captain America movie, was
the Rocketeer.
Know, yeah, well, he's coming off of Wolfman, which was like did not do well. You know, that Benicio del Toro Wolfman movie, and you know, everybody, he gets people at, they're kind of like veterans who are available for a discount. Like Kenneth Branagh, you know, was nominated for an Oscar for his first movie he directed, but by the time he got Thor, you know, he hadn't had a movie success in a few years, you know, but Kevin saw the talent and the ability to do a Shakespearean Marvel movie. And so I give him real credit as being like a talent scout, and sort of economic, you know, general manager, just a very practical.
Absolutely. Movie. You know, Disney doesn't pay well. We don't pay well, but we do thank you. We really appreciate your coming by and hanging out with us and talking about Marvel, because you've got the history and you're there at the latest moment and seeing this whole thing explode like never before. So really, Jeff, thanks for following us. Thanks for joining us on the show. People should check out your work at deadline.com. Follow your blog, Hero Nation. You got to have a Twitter handle, I'm sure.
It's just my name.
At Jeff Boucher, GEOFFBOUCHER. We'll have it in our show notes. Jeff, thanks for being here.
Thanks, guys. Thanks a lot.
Well, it was awesome to have Jeff here to talk about Marvel. He sure knows that world really well. He's been there from the start.
Yeah, I would say he should probably write a book, in my opinion. He knows way too much about it.
The history of Marvel movies would be a really cool book, and I think he would do a great job because he has been there from day one. He knows the comic books. He knows the movies. He knows the actors and the directors. He knows everyone. He knows Stan Lee. You know, he knows it all. So that's a good idea.
Would you have to get permission to do that? Not if you were writing a nonfiction book, right?
No, you wouldn't need permission. Of course not.
Yeah. You could write the unauthorized account of...
Well, unauthorized implies it's a celeb that doesn't want you to do it. It doesn't, you know, right. He wouldn't want it to be authorized because he's an independent journalist, but right. He would do a great job. What I want to know is I want the answer to why we haven't been able to see the story of Yanxi Palace yet.
Yeah, why haven't you been able to see the story of Yanxi Palace?
I don't know. This is a blockbuster China series set in a previous dynasty. It was a huge hit on China television, sort of a soap opera in a way. You know, it was a telenovela. It ran a certain length of time. The whole country stopped and watched, you know, elaborate costumes, period setting, passion, romance, intrigue, betrayal. It was kind of like Game of Thrones, but without the dragons. And it's supposed to be a huge series, and yet it has not debuted here in North America, as far as I can tell. And I don't know whether it's on the way yet. I mean, I don't see any record of it. I don't know anyone who's getting ready to show it. It sort of slipped through the cracks, and I'm not quite sure why. But there was a New Yorker article about it, and they said, you know what? China's not so thrilled with this TV show.
Yeah, well, this is the series that's somewhat critical of the government.
Well, not the government. It's set hundreds of years ago, so it's not the current government
whatsoever.
But it's
whatsoever. Kind of an allegory.
Well, no, it's not intended as an allegory, but they don't like anyone questioning any authority at all. So yeah, you're right. It's not an allegory for the current government in any way, shape, or form, but you're not supposed to question authority And that alone makes it a little nervous making fun. Plus, there are elaborate costumes and sumptuous settings and people living in luxury. And people, of course, love that. And they buy costumes, or I should say outfits, based on the designs on the show, or certain colors become popular, or they want certain objects. And that sort of lust for materialism, they also frown upon. So while it's been a big smash hit, the Chinese government is a little nervous about Yanxi Palace. I don't think that explains why it hasn't opened up anywhere else, but it is an interesting, weird little thing. We just gave you the information during box office about how to contact us. If you know why this thing has fallen through the cracks, I'd love to know, because I really want to watch it. I am looking forward to watching Wandering Earth. That premieres on Netflix April 30th. So this week, we're going to be able to watch Wandering Earth, the blockbuster Chinese sci-fi flick. I'm excited by that.
Yeah, as am I. Yeah. I mean, it was the most expensive movie ever made in China. And then, I don't know whether it still holds the record for... it may not anymore.
It's going to be passing, that's for sure. Yeah. But it didn't get great reviews, but I think it's going to be interesting just to see the quality of it and what it looks like and that sort of stuff. And I'm going to be interested to see what the Chinese people think of Roma. We were way off on Green Book. I didn't think anyone in China would care about Green Book. But that country and the people behind that movie who invested in the film turned it into, hey, we won the Oscar. Look at the film that we made and won the Oscar with. And they turned it into a sort of a cause celeb. And it hit us, struck a nerve, made good money in China. Will Roma do the same? The Alfonso Cuarón movie is opening in China May 10th. I assume, again, they have a nice, art circuit. They do have an art theater circuit, and I'm sure people who love movies will show up for it, but I don't think it's going to be a big hit. But, at least we'll get to see what the numbers are, assuming they're reported, actually.
I was going to say, no, you won't.
Oh, maybe, yeah. Maybe Netflix will
it's
not.
It's a Netflix movie. You're never going to get to see the
numbers.
Yeah,
we're not going to know what the box office is. So if you're in China and you find out, let us know.
Yeah, well, the one thing that you will not be able to see is a movie with your Cinemia subscription.
Oh, dear me.
Just, we had Rifat on the show, the CEO of Cinemia, just a couple months ago, and we started this whole section, movie subscription notes, which I guess we can close down now.
Well, no, we started with MoviePass, and then it came up with Cinemia, and everybody who's independent has been troubled. We know that the A-List and AMC and some other chains have it in the U.S. for their own chain only. We know that it also exists in that way in the U.K. and is successful, but when you're an independent person and you don't have a deal with theater chains and or the studios, the numbers just don't make sense. And it didn't work.
Which we'll talk about in our email from James Gardner of Digital. He's in Australia.
Yeah, so Cinemia in the U.S. has shut down. They say it's still working in Canada and some other countries. I haven't heard any news from people in other territories about how it's working out for them. But, the business model that we all said looked unsustainable proved unsustainable.
Well, that and the fact that they were being sued by a number of entities, including MoviePass, by the way. And they just said, look, trying to pay the legal bills... And then trying to sustain this business, I think that's an excuse.
It just made no sense.
I also know that they are focusing on SubGen, which is the technology behind Cinemia, and they're going to be offering that to circuits to offer their own subscription services, much the way Cineworld does in the UK, and you're an A-List subscriber to AMC here in the US.
Mm-hmm. And we have the other service that's coming up, Infinity.
Infinity, which is trying to
bring together independent chains and make them on a competitive level with someone like AMC. Because I am an A-List member of AMC. I subscribe to them. I pay $23 a month so I can go to all the movies I want at AMC. But boy, is it frustrating that I can't go to Metrograph or Film Forum or IFC or the other places that have some of the great art films that I really want to see.
Well, actually, that does bring us to our email from James Gardner, who a longtime listener from Australia, who I saw at CinemaCon, didn't spend nearly enough time with him. But he writes in and he says that the shuttering of Cinemia is not a surprise to him. He says, I have asked in previous emails how anyone but large cinema chains can even attempt these models. Even as a cinema chain and having control over the licensing with distributors, which greatly shapes the possibility of this model working. It's a difficult path.
Yeah, even if you're a big chain, it ain't easy.
Yeah, I simply don't see it working based on distributor licensing restrictions. Then if it does work for larger chains, will regulation kick in and stop it as it creates an unfair field for smaller independents? Licensing of the content will need to change for subscription models to have a chance, and I cannot see that happening anytime soon, as it's all mixed up with effective control of industry power. And James wrote into dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
Yeah, he makes a good points. I think we felt the same way. I had not thought about some regulation kicking in and saying, hey, MC, that's unfair. You've got an unfair advantage over smaller independents. But it is half the industry are smaller independent chains. You know, half the industry is the three big guys, AMC, Regal, and
Cinemark.
Right. And the other half are chains that are smaller. A lot of them smaller. You know, some of them 10 screens. 10 locations, 5 locations, 20 locations. There are a lot of theater chains out there in smaller towns and cities that frankly aren't competing with the big chains because the big chains aren't in their town. It's not big enough. Or they are trying to compete and hold on by appealing with art house films and smaller fare that the bigger chains just aren't as interested in. But yeah, will the government come in and kick this down? I don't think so, because they don't seem to care much about regulation right now. Maybe in a few years.
Yeah, not in the U.S., that's for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, when you look at it, Cinemia, we could see it was having trouble. I knew people who were using it and it wasn't working. So it's certainly not a big surprise or a big deal to me that it didn't work out in the end.
Well, you mentioned a big surprise there, and you also then mentioned a big deal.
Did I?
So it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about Record Store Day. April 13th marked the latest anniversary of Record Store Day, an event that was once meant to show support for indie record stores, but now is an overblown attempt to convince music fans to fork over exorbitant amounts of money for quote-unquote exclusive vinyl. And record stores are almost an afterthought at this point. Yes, 827,000 vinyl albums were sold that week, okay? The biggest haul in Record Store Day history, and the third biggest for the format since Nielsen Music began tracking sales in 1991. So what's the problem? Record stores are forced to fork over money for non-returnable merchandise, meaning they're left to hold the bag if they guess wrong on demands. Fans also can't return anything, even if the vinyl is defective. And labels don't bother to prevent piracy, so fans line up for hours hoping to snag something cool like a vinyl copy of Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks test pressing. That would be cool, actually. Then they only find out it's sold out somehow, even though resale copies are already up on eBay even before the stuff has officially gone on sale. You know, that's happened to me for almost every concert I've attended in the past 20 years. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. It's a shame. You had something nice and now success has really spoiled it. And in
fact, you can't have anything nice. Nobody can have anything nice anymore.
That's right. It used to be, I don't get that as much anymore with concert ticket sales because it's sort of taken out of the hands of record stores. You don't feel like they're ripping you off. You feel like just the bots are ripping you off. But in the old days, you'd line up at a record store and you could see the employees printing out tickets for themselves before they started to, you know, sell them to you. And that would drive you nuts. And that's what's happening here. A lot of this stuff is getting sucked up and then resold at marked up prices online. They've got to crack down and do a better job. Make sure their focus is on helping record stores and not just get a one-day shot of sugar, but get people excited about going to record stores and not feeling, you know, mistreated and mishandled when they do show up.
Could you imagine record store? Well, first of all, there's no more record stores, but employees at record stores printing out tickets today, it would be captured on a smartphone and uploaded to Facebook and Twitter, where it would go viral and everybody would get in trouble.
Right.
Now, the HBO series is Game of Thrones is reaching its biggest audience ever as the fantasy series reaches the end of its run. People are asking questions. Who will sit on the Iron Throne?
Sperling.
It seems rather uncomfortable sitting on an Iron Throne. You know, I like a little cushion, you know? I don't even know how to pronounce
Cersei.
His name. Cersei. Well, how will she die? Is it or is it a he? I don't know because I don't watch the show. Because let's be honest. Oh, it is a she. She needs to die. And by the way, who was singing that song over the end credits? Okay. Because yes, episode 2 of the final season included a touching scene where the Squire Pod sang an old tune known as Jenny of the Old Stones. During the end credits, you could hear Florence and the Machine sing that very same song. Apparently, a lot of people grabbed their phones and used the music identifying app Shazam.
Nope.
No. God darn it. One of these days it's going to work. They use that app to get the name of the song and the artist. Indeed, Shazam said about 300,000 people worldwide searched for that song in a 24-hour period, crushing the previous record when Adele's single hello, blanketed airwaves in October 2015 and was searched for some 200,000 times in a 24-hour period. So by 100,000 searches, big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop, but it's very cool. It shows you how huge a show Game of Thrones is. I mean, think the previous record holder was a big, hugely anticipated new single from the biggest artist in the world, Adele, a monster star, massive sales. People were just chomping at the bit to hear this song. Compare that to a song playing briefly in an episode on a TV show. And that broke her record. So that's kind of amazing. But it brings me to the point that music credits, music credits, music credits. You go to a movie, you have to stay through the credits, hoping you can read a music credit before it scrolls by too fast. Why in God's name do IMDb and other sources not include music credits? It drives me nuts. There are songs in movies and they should credit them and they never, never do. You won't find them on IMDb. You rarely find them on Wikipedia. It's a black hole of information and it drives me nuts.
I wonder if we could start a database that IMDb then has to purchase.
No, well, there you go. That's an idea. Yeah, you just have to grab all the info somehow, using a bot so that you don't have to redo it all over again. But it's all on celluloid print or digital prints. It's not in the internet. It's very hard to figure out what songs were played in what movies and TV shows.
Nora Roberts is one of the most successful writers of all time. Under the name J.D. Robb, she has penned dozens of near-future mystery novels. And as Nora Roberts, she has penned hundreds of best-selling books in the romance field, including contemporary and historical epics, a fantasy series, and many more types. Like Stephen King, she has never suffered from writer's block. Just writer's block buster. Get it? Writer's block and... anyway.
Keep going.
Telling all those stories is hard work, and when Roberts heard a Brazilian novelist ripped off her work, she took action. Roberts is suing Brazilian Christian Soroya, and she's suing her for copying or paraphrasing passages from at least 10 of the novels Roberts wrote. Roberts wants all books pulled until the passages are removed and at least $25,000 in damages. She will donate any proceeds to Brazilian literacy programs. Roberts isn't the only one accusing Soroya of plagiarism. Her response? In an email to Ms. Roberts' publicist, Ms. Soroya said she, quote, never intentionally plagiarized anyone. I was fooled by some mentors and coaches who told me that more, 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 fast, 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 she wrote, and blamed ghostwriters she had hired on the freelance marketplace Fiverr for the overlap between her books and others. So, that's unbelievable. So far, examples of more than 40 writers and 100 books have been allegedly ripped off. Big deal or big whoop?
She went to Fiverr to get freelancers?
I can't believe it. When I read that, I was like...
chapters of her book?
I was like, first of all, you can do that?
Yeah, exactly. I could write a book. $5. Give me a chapter. I mean, what? How does that work?
Actually, you know what? We should write a book. That way, we should say, look, this is the story. Everybody gets a chapter.
Yes.
Everybody gets a chapter, and then we'll see how it ends.
Exactly. That's just mind-blowing, truly. We should get someone on Fiverr to do our damn podcast. Maybe we can make money on it.
Unbelievable. Okay, well, let's talk about, speaking of, you know, re-editing things, Quentin Tarantino's Hateful Eight is one of those Hollywood movies that has been released in all sorts of versions. Tarantino brought back 70mm and did a super long roadshow version, complete with an orchestral prelude and an intermission. He also did a regular theatrical release, a director's cut, and so on. And now, there's a new version. His black comedy of a Western has been re-edited into a four-part Netflix miniseries that's longer than ever. But don't get excited. The extra running time is just the result of adding in opening and closing credits to all four parts. Hilarious! A movie that nodded back to the glory days of Hollywood and celluloid has just been updated for binge watching on Netflix. Big deal or big whoop?
Or just ironic. I would say it's just ironic. What's ironic, however, is that the roadshow production version is not available on Netflix. They want to cut it into four parts, okay, but everybody seems to be of the consensus that it wasn't broken up very smartly or wisely, and this film doesn't really benefit from that. But why the heck don't they have the long theatrical version available? It would be so easy, you know? That's what drives me nuts. Make that, you know, ultimate director's version available. This isn't his suddenly preferred final cut. This is just another option he's allowed them to do. So that's great. I don't care. Cut it as many ways as you want, but you should always have the ideal theatrical version there. you know, Coppola is redoing Apocalypse Now again, putting it out in theaters again in a new extra half hour long version. That's fine, but always make sure the original version is available. And when you got something like Netflix, where it's so easy to offer two different versions, it doesn't really take much effort at all. It's crazy that they don't do it.
Much like Avengers Endgame, the Korean boy band BTS continues to set records. It became the first Korean act to hit number one on the album charts in the United Kingdom. And now BTS just released its third number one album on the US Billboard charts in a 12-month period. Songs are charting higher and higher with streaming and an ardent fan base. BTS can make a big splash when an album drops. In the case of their new offering, Persona, thanks to 198,000 actual album sales, physical album sales in people's hands.
Or digital,
you're right.
Yeah.
They've done it with albums performed mostly in Korean, when it's rare for any album not in English to chart. But they're still working for that inescapable song that makes them a household name instead of just three letters. And the competition is getting fierce. Backstreet Boys, they're back. The Jonas Brothers, they're back too. And now NSYNC has decided they might come back too. Justin Timberlake or no Justin Timberlake. Maybe they can actually sing this time instead of lip-syncing like they did with Ariana Grande at Coachella. Big deal or big whoop?
I thought it was Justin Bieber you said.
Both of them lip-synced.
Oh, well, a lot of dancing. I think it's a big deal. This is, you know, groundbreaking stuff for an international band that does not sing in English. This is crazy big stuff. It's easy to say, oh, yeah, they did it again. It's really landmark. It's amazing to see. I think it's great. It's really healthy. You know, all music is world music. When Springsteen is being listened to in Italy, that's world music. So I'm delighted that people are embracing BTS. I think it's cool to see. I wish their music was better. And I think Justin Timberlake should join NSYNC, frankly. You know what? His last few albums have been very poor selling, not a lot of fire excitement. Why not have a reunion with them? It'd be a fun thing to juice your career.
The case of actor Jussie Smollett gets more confusing day by day. We've mostly avoided it and thanked the gods for that. Smollett plays a gay character on the TV show Empire, and he seemed to be the victim of a horrific hate crime. But then he seemed to be the mastermind of faking that stunt to get more and more money, I guess, or more airtime or something, more of something. The evidence seemed overwhelming. Check Smollett wrote to the men who allegedly attacked him, with those same men ready to say he convinced them to do it. It was ugly. For some reason, the charges were dropped. His lawyer says the actor is innocent and the charges would not have stuck. Now the police are suing Smollett for the cost of investigating the fake hate crime, or what they're calling a fake hate crime. To top it off, the cast of Empire has written an open letter saying Smollett has not been charged with any crime. They know and love him and believe he should be a part of the show in the next season. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, my God. I wish it was a big whoop. I'm sorry for all the attention it's gotten. It's an awful thing to have done if it happened. I don't understand any of it, especially why charges were dropped. It's mind-boggling. The police are angry at the attorney's office. The attorneys are angry at the police. Everybody's angry at Jussie Smollett. But his cast wants him back. That's confusing, too. But there you go. This is just a big nightmare of a thing. But I felt like we just couldn't ignore it any longer.
So listen, everybody just has to calm down, okay? Steven Spielberg does not hate Netflix, okay? Woo! In fact, he loves Netflix. And really, he's been frustrated that theater chains weren't more accommodating of Roma. How do we know this, okay? Two people close to Spielberg spoke to the New York Times and said he's been very frustrated by how the media has portrayed his attitude towards the streamer. Spielberg was repeatedly described by the media as campaigning for Green Book and against Netflix. It's all a big misunderstanding. Spielberg apparently even called major theater chains and begged them to show Roma after it was available for streaming. He binge watches shows on the channel. He's making shows for them and Apple. Yes, sure. If the Academy suggested a rules change that meant only films with robust theatrical releases would be eligible for the Oscars, he would probably vote for it, okay? But put that aside for a second. Otherwise, he's not some Luddite and is really annoyed when the media says he hates Netflix. Nonetheless, the Academy met and made no changes to its rules that would affect streamers in any way, shape, or form. So Martin Scorsese's The Irishman can still be Oscar bait this fall. You know, Spielberg was so angry when he heard this, he went to one of his electronic mail machines to write into them. Big deal or big whoop?
What was that last one?
Well, you said he wasn't a Luddite, so I said he went to his electronic mail machine.
Okay. Yes. This is a big whoop, but it's hilarious. Spielberg actually did respond to the New York Times for this article. He responded in an email to some questions that they posed him. But the idea that he's sitting there helplessly for months, upset how people are portraying his comments, rather than just picking up a phone and talking to a journalist as if nobody would be willing to quote him, you know, as if he couldn't have ended it immediately. It's just absurd. It's like, no, you spoke up, you were upset and annoyed how everybody attacked you and said you were an idiot, you don't know what you're talking about, and what about this, this, and this? Another filmmaker said, yeah, you know what? I just got my movie made in Netflix. I like to make films for adults, and the studios aren't interested, so why don't you back off, Buster, who can get any movie made that you want? You know, and he was, I think, upset and annoyed and chagrined. He's not used to being questioned. He's not used to people saying, what are you talking about? But he and Lucas, they're, you know, well past their prime. They sometimes say stupid stuff about movies and studios. They don't know what they're talking about. And that's certainly the case here. And the idea, again, that he's helplessly listening, oh, why don't they portray what I say accurately? Pick up a phone, call any journalist in the world. They'll take your call. By the way, the Oscars did make one ghoul rule change. Ghoul rule change? They made one good rule change. I've been calling about this for years. They changed the category of best foreign film to best international film. It seems like a small, silly thing, but you know what? It's not foreign to you if you're in Italy, France, Germany, Spain, Poland, Japan, you know. It's
Mexico.
Right. It's an international film. And, you know, foreign has a negative connotation. CNN stops using the word foreign decades ago. Ted Turner suggested that, and I thought that makes a lot of sense. And I've always been aware of that at the Oscars and how that should change too. Finally, it's come to pass.
Spotify launched its streaming service in India, speaking of international markets. But the way they're acting, you'd think it was the Wild West. Spotify seems to be arguing that the rules don't apply to them. First, they couldn't reach an agreement with Warner Music Group after long negotiations. So, you know, they went ahead and included Warner Music Group's music anyway, insisting they didn't need a deal with the company to do so. Now they're facing similar blowback from India's oldest and most venerable label, Saregama. Spotify negotiated with them and was even permitted to access the company's music prior to launch. However, a deal was never actually finalized, says the company. So stop using our music! Spotify now has a fortnight to comply. And by fortnight, we do not mean the video game. Big deal, big whoop.
That's right. We shouldn't say that anymore. What a fortnight! It's a big deal. You know, this it's a very bumpy launch in India for Spotify. Actually, I should say it's a big whoop because long term it won't make any difference. But they're sure not making any friends when you're doing something like this. You know, you should be making friends, coming to new territory, get people excited about your service. Instead, they're coming in with elbows akimbo. Not a good idea. And they've got competition. The India streamer Gaana hit 100 million users. Apparently, they just reported that. It is free if you use ads. It's like the freemium level is free. That reaches 100 million people. If you pay for a subscription, then you can download songs and listen to them when you're away from Wi-Fi. Otherwise, when you're using Gaana, which is what most people are doing, you have to have Wi-Fi available. So you can't go in the subway or somewhere where there's no Wi-Fi. So that streamer is doing great. Spotify has launched very bumpily. And there's lots of competition all over the world. Amazon, by the way, is getting to launch a high def streaming service. It'll cost $15 a month and give you sound quality better than a CD, higher bit rate than a compact disc. You know what? I wish Spotify offered that because I would pay a premium for that.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And to this date, the WGA showdown with talent agencies still does not affect you. It will at some point, but it might take a long, long time.
It will if you're an agent or a writer.
Oh, that's true. Actually, yeah. That's true.
We've got people in the business listening, baby. So, the Hollywood, a couple things have popped up. We have some good reporting from the Hollywood Reporter. We have links in our show notes. A good link from Deadline with Jeff Boucher's platform where they're talking about why smaller agencies aren't signing on to the code of conduct. Some good stuff that I haven't thought about yet. First up is Hollywood Reporter said, you know what? This whole schmingle is going to maybe create problems for Endeavor. They were planning to go public. A lot of the agents, a lot of the big agencies, they already have private financing, but now Endeavor was planning to launch an IPO.
And well, now, remember, when you're private equity,
that's when they make their money.
Yeah, they need to either sell you, so you sell you to another owner, or you need to go public so that they can cash out, because those funds need to kind of pay back their investors.
Right. So now all these people are upset because they're realizing this plan to go public may be hampered by these legal battles. Who? What are you going to value Endeavor at when they're in a showdown with writers and one of their main sources of funding, packaging fees, is being challenged pretty substantially by writers? We don't know where it's going to end up. Do you want to go public with that cloud hanging over your head? Maybe not.
Well, not a single agency has signed this code of conduct that was written by the WGA and sent off to the ATA, the Association of Talent Agents.
And what are the three big ones? What are the three big agents?
Well, I guess you could say Creative Artists Agency, ICM, which I believe is International Creative Management, and United Talent Agency, UTA. There's also Agency for the Performing Arts, APA. Paradigm is another one.
Well, there's tons of them. There's 100+ agencies in Hollywood. But the big three, we know why they haven't signed on, because they're not willing to give up packaging. And now they're starting to produce shows, and some of them have private investors and they're planning to go public. So they have no interest in caving in on this. But as Deadline said, you know what? There are more than 100 small agencies. They have little or no packaging. They don't produce stuff. So why hasn't anyone signed up on the new code of conduct? Not only could they sign up, but they might be able to poach some big name clients who'd say, you know what? I'm free. You're willing to abide by these terms. I'm tired of doing it alone. Fine. I'll go with you.
Well, okay. A couple things. One, the code of conduct, the ATA says, look, we can't sign it because it says that the Writers Guild of America can just change the code of conduct at will and we won't have to re-sign. It'll just change and we'll have to abide by whatever it comes up with. That's a no-go. Now, the WGA says that's not true. That's paragraph one. If you read the other paragraph, it says that, you know, you would have to agree. Be that as it may, probably the biggest thing is that the code of conduct demands that agents turn in any contract that is signed by a writer to the Writers Guild so that they have it on record.
So the WGA says they're going to automatically demand it for, it's not just if they want it, they're going to always ask every deal memo be submitted to the WGA so they can have it on file.
Yes, not before it's signed. I mean, you can sign it, do whatever you want. But then once it's signed, you have like 30 days to then send it to the WGA. They put it on file.
And they're not asking you to anonymize the information. They're not asking to say, we just want to know in general what people are getting. We want to anonymize it. We'll make sure that it's not in our records as being from your agency or that agency. It's just a writer on a show for Fox got this amount working in the staff or working as executive. They're not doing any of that. It's just literally the contract. And who would have access to look at it, we wonder.
Yeah, well, so do all the agents. And by the way, so do the studios
and the writers,
the networks.
Some of the writers. And,
yeah, well, here's the thing. The WGA would already have this and should already have this. You know why? It's in the WGA's contracts with each of their members. The members are supposed to be sending in the contracts themselves, and they don't. And there's a reason for that. They're not allowed to, because it's in the contracts that the terms remain confidential.
They're saying that needs to end. The confidentiality needs to end. So that's not a contradiction. They're saying we've always wanted it. Our writers have been hamstrung. And now, along with these other things, we want to end this practice as well.
Yeah, the writers don't
want transparency.
Yeah, the writers don't want it.
But they are the writers. The WGA is the writers. So you can't say the writers don't want it, because they are the writers.
The writers themselves, and if you read some of the comments on some of these stories, writers for shows have written in the comments section,
But they supported it by a vast majority. 95-98% of them signed on, and they fired their agents. So clearly, they must support it in some way, shape, or form.
They've signed on to something much larger, which is the end of packaging fees, the end of these affiliated production companies. Mm-hmm. That's what they signed on.
They're not trying
for.
To pull a fast one on their own members. They're not trying to trick their own members into doing something they don't want. I understand what you're saying, but surely the WGA, if it's asking for it, must believe that most members want that. They cannot think they don't want this, they hate this, but we're going to do it anyway. They're representing their own writers. Unless you think for some bizarre reason, all the people involved
couldn't get it out of their own writers. They can't get it.
The writers aren't allowed legally. They're saying they don't want to be hamstrung anymore. They've always wanted this information. The writers aren't allowed to do it. And now they're trying to force the issue, just as they want to end packaging fees. They want to end the inability of writers to share their own deal information with their own, Writers Guild Association. So I would want more information from somebody who could genuinely show, oh my God, every writer hates this, even though that's what they're asking for. you understand the conflict here. They represent writers. They've wanted this. They're asking for it. And you're saying, well, yeah, but they hate that. Well, I'm not convinced. There must be some reason the WGA wants it. And there must be some reason most writers are willing to support it. Unless you're thinking they've all been tricked and they have no idea of what's in their own negotiating platform. If most writers don't want it, I assume it will be removed. Why would they? Why would they go on? Why would they fire their agents demanding something they don't want? But the idea that the talent agent's saying, oh, look at all this other stuff, that's why we're not signing. B, the WGA saying, look, everything in here is negotiable. We haven't negotiated yet. They're saying it's in a contract, but the stuff about, you know, this, that, and the other thing, it's just not to say, oh, we can't sign it because of them. Well, we haven't negotiated yet. You know, the thing you'd object to, that's where we negotiate. That's where we talk. You like this, you like that, I like this, I like that, and you work it out. So claiming none of them want to do it because of how their initial argument has been presented. You know, this is what they step forward with. This is what their beginning argument is. And then you argue with some stuff. Some is removed, some is changed, some is added in, and then you've got a final deal. So I think it's disingenuous. Nonetheless, none of the agencies have signed on to it. Probably because the negotiating stuff hasn't happened yet, because the big ones aren't going to budge.
Right. Well, and you know, I've heard that the WGA has kind of set up this like staffing season, for these shows to staff with its members.
Yeah, and yeah, they're doing all sorts of things to try to help people connect with other writers. Yes, of course, we talked about it. They've got message boards, they've got Twitter feeds, they've got all sorts of things and ways to try and link up writers with work.
Well, you know who won't be working anymore?
Who?
And probably wasn't working before.
No.
Doris Roberts.
She was working close to the end.
Yeah, but she was 90 years old.
So is my mom. You're telling me my mom's going to die?
Is she working on a television show?
She could. Yes, so Doris Roberts of Everybody Loves Raymond, of course, died at 90. She's a 5-time Emmy winner, best known for the role of nudgy mother-in-law Doris Barone on the classic sitcom. Classic, or at least wildly popular, successful sitcom. What a career she had. She took acting classes with Marilyn Monroe and Geraldine Page, among others, at the Actors Studio. She had her first live role on TV in 1951. She made her Broadway debut in 1955. She had 11 Emmy nominations overall. She really broke through in the 70s on the sitcom Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, followed by 2 seasons as the mom on Angie, a sitcom that ran in 1979 and 1980, starring Donna Pesco. I, as a 13-year-old kid in 1979, proving I was a wunderkind, a gay boy, or I don't know what to say, but I watched Angie and thought, she's good. I saw Doris Roberts and was like, she's very good. Way back at 13 years old. That's an odd kid. She won an Emmy for her guest role on St. Elsewhere in 1982. Then she had her big break. A supporting role on Remington Steele garnered her another Emmy nomination and lots of attention. She appeared in 71 episodes as Mildred Krebs. That was from 1983 to 1987. You know, at the time, you know, she's you know, in her 60s, breaking through and, you know, having the biggest success she'd probably ever have in her career. You know, that was it. A character everybody knew, a show, she got Emmy nominations, great work, a beloved actor who'd done everything you could think of. And then at the age of 70, when most people are retired, almost a decade after her huge success on Remington Steele, the biggest she'd ever had in her career, she landed the role on Everybody Loves Raymond and hit the jackpot. 1995, ran for what, 12 seasons? One of the biggest hits you can ever have, an iconic character. That's a career. And you know what? It took her 70 years to finally, you know, grab the brass ring, but by God, she did it.
So you're saying there's still hope for us?
There's definitely still hope for us. And my mom doesn't like her. She watches Everybody Loves Raymond every day. And she's like, she's not nice. She's so mean, my mom says all the time. And now she's starting to say one of her catchphrases. Apparently when Raymond or his brother says something, a little sexual innuendo or anything they don't like, she goes, I don't like that, Raymond. I don't like that, Raymond. And my mom says that. I don't like that, Michael.
Well, hopefully you liked our show this week.
I hope so.
And hopefully you'll like it. Next week, you could like it every week if you just subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find our show. You can rate, review our show there. You can find that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can find links to all of the stories that we've discussed today, including Jeff Boucher's work. I'd like to thank Jeff for stopping by and talking about Avengers Endgame. You can find all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's idontlikethat.com.
I'm sure
it's for it is taken, but you can buy it for a cheap $2,400. Keep dreaming, fella, whoever bought that domain and thought they were going to make big bucks. Keep dreaming.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.